Welcome to the show, Nora.
Thanks for having me.
This is the, I guess, first time the listener will hear you, but we tried to do recording in Yellowknife. When was that? In July. And unfortunately, we lost the recording. So, I'm pleased to have you back on. And I guess it's never as nice not doing them in person, but, you know, we'll settle with what we can do. You're in Winnipeg, aren't you?
Yeah.
And now I'm in Halifax, so here we go. 4,000 kilometers apart or something like that. maybe start by filling everybody in on who you are and what you do, and then I guess you can kind of jump from that into explain to me how the hydrology of rivers is changing and why people who paddle rivers should care.
Sure. So I'm a Canada research chair at the University of Winnipeg, and my area of research is on how human activity on landscapes influences water quantity and quality in streams, wetlands, and lakes. And so I have in the past studied a variety of different kinds of human influences, things like acid rain or agriculture or forestry, but probably the biggest human activity that's influencing rivers is climate change. And so a lot of the work in our lab looks at how changing climate influences the water that flows in streams and also the nutrients and chemicals and pollutants that get from the landscape into the stream.
Right. And what is the change you're seeing? Like, if you graph water flow through a typical Canadian river, you know, on a yearly basis, I think there's fluctuation, but you know, I think most people would know that in the winter, with the accumulation of snow, there's, you know, traditionally less, and then in the spring you get a big the thaw event and the water levels rise, and then, you know, they peter off into the summer. But yeah, what are you seeing?
Yeah, so most places in Canada have that kind of typical annual cycle, where most of the flow in a river, sometimes up to 50% or more, occurs during the spring snow melt. And that kind of resets the river for the whole year. You get really high flows at that time, and then you have some rainstorms through the summer and fall, which will raise the level of the river. But typically most of the flow occurs during spring melt. And one of the most pronounced climate changes that we're seeing across Canada are changes during the winter season. So winters are a little bit different from other seasons in places like Canada that are seasonally covered in snow, because we've got this hard physical threshold of 0 degrees Celsius. So if the temperature is above zero, the water melts and it rains, or the snowpack melts and flows into the river. And if it's if it's below zero, it stays as a solid. And so temperature changes during the winter can have really big effects on the ways that water moves through landscapes and ultimately into streams. So my colleagues and I have done a whole bunch of work about how winters have changed in the last 100 years across eastern Canada, and we're seeing three things. So winters are getting shorter, the winters are getting warmer, and winters are getting less snowy. And so what that means for the streams is that spring snow melt is, first of all, occurring earlier in the year, in some places up to a month earlier than it occurred 100 years ago. And also, it's a lot smaller. than it has been historically. And that's because if there's less snow that accumulates on the ground, there's going to be a smaller snow melt, and then less runoff into the stream. And so that results in kind of a flattening of the cycle of stream flow throughout the year, which hydrologists call a hydrograph, meaning that instead of having a big spike in the spring and then some smaller peaks later in the year, the water is distributed more evenly throughout the year. And then the other kind of interesting effect that we've seen is we're seeing an increase in midwinter melt events. So typically, if depending on the size of the stream, maybe it doesn't flow in the winter, or there's just a little bit of kind of base flow that trickles out underneath the frozen soil. If you get times during the winter when the temperature crosses that 0 degree threshold, you have snow that melts, flows into the river, so you can get big kind of floods that occur in the winter season when we're not used to them.
Right. And, you know, for paddlers, it has an obvious real world implication in that, you know, a lot of rivers can only be paddled at certain water levels. You know, it's always been a big thing for paddlers, you know, to look forward for the spring melt and high water. And, you know, several rivers in Nova Scotia really can only be paddled in high water. And I'm sure there's, you know, lots of rivers like that across the country. So, I mean, like, that's a real weird implication for paddlers. But, like, what other, I would imagine this phenomenon has all sorts of ecological impacts as well. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, for sure. So the spring melt is important not just for the quantity of water, but also for the quality of water, the nutrients and other chemicals that are delivered from the watershed to lakes. And so shifting the timing of that delivery back in the year creates a mismatch in timing between when the lake could take those nutrients up and when they're actually delivered. So we're seeing changes in algae in the lakes. The earlier snow melt means also that the lakes are ice free for a longer period of time. So in some places that's linked to increases in algal blooms, which can be bad for people and pets. So that's also of interest to people who like to paddle across lakes.
For sure.
And then the other thing with the changing winters is there's all kinds of impacts on the way that people live their lives. For instance, municipalities might be ready for a big flood in the spring when they're used to it. They might not have their snow clearing equipment or their other equipment available in the middle of the winter for these more frequent midwinter melts. There's all kinds of stuff that depends on the water being frozen. In Winnipeg here, we have this huge skating rink on the river, kind of like the one on the canal in Ottawa. And so as the winters get shorter, the length of time or our ability to do those kind of recreational winter activities that we enjoy gets less. So sometimes when I'm talking about winter climate change, people think, oh, it would be great. You know, I don't really like the cold. It would be great if it was a little bit warmer. But there's all kinds of both human activities and ecological processes that depend on it being cold and snowy.
Yeah, no doubt. I hate it when people say that, because it's like, you know, winter just gets slushier and rainier, you know. I think that's way less fun than snow.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing, like, Canada's obviously a really big place with kind of a range of climates. And places like Halifax or like Southern Ontario, where I grew up, those areas are going through like a really profound change in the winter. I was just working on some data that someone in the state sent me, looking at the kind of Eastern North America area. And by the end of the century, the data that she sent me showed that the majority of days in the winter are going to be above zero in the middle of the day in kind of the Halifax area by the end of the century. So that's like a real change. You know, somewhere like Winnipeg, where it's a bit colder, or Yellowknife, where it's a bit colder, you know, the season will get shorter and we'll lose those really cold days. But Southern Canada is going to go from being kind of cold and snowy and reliably frozen to slushy.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned it earlier, like because at the 0 degree mark, water switches to being ice and snow. It like has such a profound, like climates that are that cross that threshold have such a profound impact on the way of life and the ecosystem. Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, if you're on the equator and it's like, you know, always, you know, 20 in the 20s or 30s, like adding an extra degree or two, like obviously has impacts, but not like major impacts on how people live their lives, but where you're in climates like Toronto or Halifax or somewhere along the southern border in Canada, you know, you can go from being like a winter paradise with frozen lakes and snow to a place that has none of that just by changing a couple degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think the other thing I like to talk about when I'm talking about climate change is, I think when you read things like, oh, we have to keep the warming under 2 degrees, under a degree and a half, that doesn't really mean anything to me, and I'm someone who looks at climate data all the time. But I think when you start to say, you know, we're going to have 2 weeks less of winter, or we're going to go from most of the days being below zero to most of the days being above zero, I think those are things that are kind of tangible and changes that people can understand a little bit better.
For sure, yeah. You mentioned algae, and I just wanted, you know, I'm off topic here, but did you read about these, like this, I think it was a couple and their dog who were found dead in California?
Ooh, I didn't. On
the side of
that.
A hiking trail, yeah.
Ooh.
And the leading culprit currently, the leading theory is algae bloom. Like there's no evidence of any foul play, and you know, no reason to believe that anyone, you know, I think they're doing detailed autopsies, but like the initial autopsy showed no blunt force trauma or anything to either one of them.
Yeah.
And the dog was there dead with them too. But,
yeah, that's like a horror movie.
Totally.
The thing about algae and climate is that, like, there's lots of places in Canada that have bad algae blooms kind of naturally occurring. Like the prairies are a place that where the lakes are pretty green to begin with, just because it's like a naturally really productive place. That's why we have all the good agriculture. But there's also all kinds of places in Canada where we don't get algae blooms in the lake, like anywhere on the Canadian Shield, right, is really characterized by these deep, clear lakes without very much plant or algae growth. And worryingly, we're seeing increases in algal blooms in those kinds of boreal lakes. And in particular, we're seeing increases in these toxic algal blooms. And it's a little bit of a kind of open scientific question as to why we're seeing that, because it's not, you know, there's no cities in these places that have sewage effluent that's causing the algae. There's no agriculture, so it sort of must be something about changes to the climate and changes in the forest processes that are resulting in the algae blooms. And I think for lots of people who paddle, that really resonates with folks who've spent a lot of time kind of on those deep, clear lakes.
Yeah. The more I read about, you know, blue-green algae and these various, I don't know much about them, but the more I read about them, the more you kind of can freak yourself out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it's not good. And the pets are kind of the thing that are who are often affected by the algae. I guess they're, you know, kind of smaller bodies. I don't know much about the toxicology, but often it's that the pet gets sick.
Yeah, but and even like I don't know if you're familiar with this unidentified disease in New Brunswick now that
right, yeah,
you know, that is similar. You know, it was initially mistaken as like mad cow, or what's the one they get in deer, chronic wasting disease.
Oh yeah,
it was initially thought to be something like that, but it's not. And then there was an article in Globe and Mail last week, I think it was, that kind of the leading suspect now is that I think they're up to about 60 people who have it, and it's generally fatal. But anyway, the leading culprit is some sort of algae bloom.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
it's scary stuff.
See that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is really scary stuff.
So how? I mean, and maybe I'm getting into the weeds here, but you mentioned that, you know, the changes in delivery of water to a lake, like this flattening of the curve that we're seeing,
mm-hmm.
can have an impact on algae. Like, what do you mean? Like,
yeah.
How's that?
Yeah.
Happening?
Yeah. It's a little bit technical, so you can kind of bear with me. But algae, like any plants, need a whole bunch of different things to grow. They need light. They need carbon dioxide. And they need nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus. And depending on the ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus that you have, you'll get different species of algae growing in a lake. The blue-green algae favor a certain ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus. And those blue-green ones are typically the ones that produce toxins. And so that's what's kind of going on in the lake. When you have snow melts that shift back earlier in the year, there tends to be a lot more nitrogen in the snow than phosphorus, just because nitrogen is mostly in the air and phosphorus is mostly in the soil. So as you shift the timing of the snow melt, you get a big flush of nitrogen early in the season when there aren't any algae to take it up. And then that's going to shift that ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus later in the year, which can shift the algae towards these blue-green algae, which are potentially more toxic.
Wow.
So that's, it's like, it's quite a complicated system, obviously, and there's lots of moving parts, but that's kind of one of the hypotheses about why changes in climate might lead to increases in the toxic algal bloom.
Right. Are you seeing changes to fish populations?
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of that has to do with two things. Some fish need cold water to breed. And so as air temperatures go up, the water temperatures can go up as well. And the fish can kind of get thermally squeezed out, like the amount of cold water that the fish for the fish to breed, particularly in the kind of early part of the season, can just get smaller, and so all the fish kind of have to pack into the cold water. So that can favor fish that don't need that cold water. And in some cases, like here in Manitoba, that's often the invasive fish, like the carp, do really well in kind of warm water. So that affects the fish population. And then the other thing that affects the fish population is if you have a lot of algae in a lake, the algae is going to bloom and then it dies and sinks down to the bottom of the lake and decomposes. And as it decomposes, that uses up all the oxygen, and the fish need oxygen as well. So big algal blooms often can lead to fish kills. The kind of classic example of that was Lake Erie in the 70s or 80s before they banned phosphate in detergents when there were bad algal blooms there.
Right. What's this phenomenon called, this, you know, flattening of the
hydrography? Yeah, I think that's what I would call it, the flattening of the hydrograph. Not super catchy, I guess.
No.
Well, we should call it flattening the curve or something.
That we're all familiar with the term flattening the curve.
Yeah. Yeah.
How, just out of curiosity, how do you measure water flow through a river?
Yeah, that is a really good question. You do it, and it's kind of complicated, and I think people who paddle on rivers will be familiar with why it's complicated. So if you have a small stream, what you do is you force all of the water over a weir or like a little dam so that you constrain all the water, and then you just measure the change in depth in the water, and that'll be equivalent to the change in volume if you know the kind of geometry of the stream.
Yeah.
But if you have a big stream or river, you can't do that. That's not feasible. And then second of all, the water's going to be moving at different speeds in different places in the river. And again, paddlers know this really well. Like the fastest water moves in the middle of the stream, kind of about two-thirds of the way up, where there's the least amount of friction with either the air or the riverbed.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to measure the volume of water, you need to take a bunch of measurements across the stream and then average it out. It becomes quite a challenging thing to do.
No doubt. I know well what you're talking about, because when we paddled the Mackenzie earlier in the summer, there was this strange phenomenon where it's such a big river, you know, like there's points when it's a couple kilometers wide.
Yeah.
Where you'd be out in the middle of the river and, you know, there's lots of driftwood and like the shore is really far, it can be a kilometer away. So like you have this sensation of not really moving at all. Like you're just on a big lake.
Mm-hmm.
Relative to, you know, the bubbles and the foam and driftwood and whatever else is floating in like in the water column, you're not moving at all. But really you're like flying down the river because it's the fastest part of the river. And when you're like up tight to shore, it feels like you're going fast, but you're actually, you know, it's like the slowest part of the river. So it's just it was a strange, like I knew the whole time that the fastest place to be paddling was the middle, but like, it just did not feel like the fastest place.
Yeah. That's always wild, and when you can't, it's related to how you can't really tell how far away the shore is when you're in the middle of the river.
Yeah. What sort of timeline are you, like, this flattening that you're seeing, is it something that's happening rapidly, or like do you have a grasp on the timeline? And you know, the reason I ask is because, you know, I think climate change is such a hard problem for like the human species to grasp, just based on our life expectancy. You know, there's like don't know if you've heard the term, you know, the term shifting baseline syndrome, but like in one's life, it's like hard to really see climate change. But then when you read a, you know, an account, like for instance, the book on the, as we were going down the Mackenzie River, I was reading a book about the Mackenzie River, and it was quoting, you know, parts of Mackenzie's journey from, I think it was the early, like 1820s or so.
Yeah.
And, you know, compared to his account, which he did almost the same time of year, like when he arrived at the Arctic Ocean, it was frozen solid. And when we arrived at the Arctic Ocean, it was like, no, there was no ice to be found.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, over a couple hundred years, you can really grasp the problem, but over, you know, 10 or 20 years, it's easy just to confuse it with seasonal variability.
Totally.
So like, and what type of timeline are you seeing?
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is, when it comes to measuring streams, we don't have good, like, scientific measurements of streams that go back to the 1800s. You know, most of the instrument records in Canada, if we're lucky, they start at the early 1900s. Many of them start much later. So are like, you know, there are accounts like in the book you were reading, or there's traditional knowledge of Indigenous people who have lived on the land for a really long time, but we're sort of lucky when we have a 100-year record of streams. In this work that my colleagues and I did, we were using historical data, and we were only using sites that had 100 years of data. And over those 100 years, the kind of magnitude of changes we were seeing were things like the winter was on average 2 weeks shorter. So the snow melt was occurring on average 2 weeks earlier in the season. But there's a lot of both year-to-year variability, and I think everyone has that experience, where sometimes winter's really long, sometimes it's really short. And then there's also like site-to-site variability, spatial variability. And again, I think people will be familiar with that, where you can have, like this past year in Manitoba was a really, really low snow year. So we had a really small, snow melt. Whereas in other parts of the country, like up in Yellowknife, it was above average snow, so it was kind of a big snow melt year. So I think we can both look at the at that historical record, where maybe we've seen winters get shorter by a couple of weeks over the last 100 years, and then the projections for the future are that rate of change will be faster than it's been in the past, and the rate of change depends on the types of decisions that we as humans make about mitigating climate change and reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Right. Is the hydroelectric industry taking great interest in your research and, you know, what your lab is doing?
Yeah, I mean, the people who operate hydroelectric dams have very, very good records of flows in rivers, and are extremely aware of how things have changed over the last 100 years. The really big rivers kind of in northern Canada that have big hydroelectric developments on them, they drain just like huge areas of the country, and so to a certain extent the amount of water is somewhat constant, because it's just like such a big area that if it's dry in one place, it might be wet in another place, so it all kind of averages out. But yeah, I mean, they're definitely they're definitely interested in how the climate is changing. But actually, in Manitoba, one of the things that Hydro here has invested a lot in research has to do with ice jam floods, which are occurring more frequently as we get these midwinter melts. You know, the ice will break up and then refreeze in the middle of the winter, and that can cause a big flood coming out of that ice jam. And that's really bad because as the ice freezes and thaws, it's super, super powerful, and it can destroy infrastructure. It can damage dams and other things that are in the water. So they've put a lot of effort into understanding ice jams and figuring out ways to mitigate them.
Oh, that's interesting. With where in an environment like Yellowknife, for instance, you get basically one freeze. Everything freezes up in end of October, and then everything's frozen solid until it melts in May. But where you're in one of these climates that is kind of hovering around that cusp or has multiple freeze thaws in the winter, you get these ice jams. That's interesting. That had not occurred to me, but I can see that being a big problem. Having witnessed a breakup on the Mackenzie River where the ice is just taking stuff out,
It's wild, the force behind that ice. When I moved to Winnipeg in 2014, I'd done my PhD on this kind of stuff, and I came and I was really keen, and I gave this talk about winter climate change to the people in my new department, and they one person put up their hand and said, that's great, but you see that in Southern Ontario, but here in Winnipeg, it's just cold all winter. You never get these midwinter thaws. You're just going to have to find something else to study. And every year that I've been here for the last 7 years, there's been multiple midwinter thaws in Winnipeg. So even these places that historically have had really consistent cold temperatures are seeing increases in these winter warming events.
Yeah, you see that so frequently here in Nova Scotia, and even I grew up in New Brunswick, and I feel like you see more of them now than I did when I was a kid,
data bear you out on that. That's not just the data would say that as well, that you see more now than you did 30 years ago.
And is that in any way related to the I don't know if this is the right term, but the shifting of the Gulf Stream or these oscillations, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Warm air comes up and then cold air comes down. It seems to me that band is the band on warm and cold air is wider than it used to be.
Yeah. There's a hypothesis from meteorologists, not the ones on TV, but the people who study weather, scientists who study weather, that the warmer temperatures in the Arctic have made the air masses in the upper atmosphere in the Arctic more unstable, which causes the jet stream, which typically is kind of in a stable place geographically, to not be fixed in location. Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of the really cold weather that the kind of southern part of Canada has experienced in the last 10 or so years, they've attributed to changes in the jet stream. And again, you can have that happen 1 year, and that's just kind of the natural variability in the system. But what they're saying is as the Arctic warms, we're going to start to see more of this unstable jet stream pattern, more of these huge swings between really, really cold temperatures and really warm temperatures.
Yeah, but that theory makes a lot of sense to me because for every story you read in Canada in the winter about how it's way above normal somewhere in the north, you also get these events like the snow and freezing. It was in Texas.
Yeah.
Like
cold,
extreme cold weather way down deep into the southern states or Mexico where, like, they're just not used to it.
Yeah. 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 And there's a fair amount of evidence that the frequency of those events is changing, and it's linked to these human-caused changes in the climate system.
Right. How'd you get into the study of rivers, by the way?
As I said, grew up in kind of southeastern Ontario, and grew up in and around Algonquin Park, spending a lot of time paddling on the lakes there as a kid and a teenager. So I really loved that. And then I went to university and I was doing a degree in biology, and I hated it. I decided I didn't like plants and I didn't like animals, and I was gonna go do something else. But I got a job working as a summer research assistant for one of the professors in my department. And the job was based up near Sault Ste. Marie, and she handed me and this other research assistant a couple of probes, and she said, your job is to walk around the forest for the whole summer and take measurements of the soil and the water and make a map of what those patterns look like. And I just thought, wow, someone's going to pay me to do this for the summer. This is the best job. And so I love that field work aspect of it, but what I kind of kept me going was I really love kind of, it's like a big puzzle trying to figure out how ecosystems work, and that's really interesting to me, trying to kind of put all those different pieces together and solve those kinds of puzzles. And then also I think it has really important implications for lakes and streams, which are things that Canadians really value and that we get a lot of pleasure out of to use recreationally. There's lots of economic activities that depend on it, and there's lots of ecological processes that depend on it. So I'm always looking for ways in which this research can be helpful to people or can help decision makers make good decisions to protect our natural resources.
Oh, that's a noble goal. I mean,
it doesn't always work that way, but that's the goal.
No, it's true. You know, they're the Canadian identity is, I think, deeply rooted in rivers and lakes and, you know, what do Canadians do on the weekend in the summer? They, like, if you don't live in either the Atlantic provinces or coastal British Columbia, you're going to the lake or fishing in the river or canoeing or, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always say, thank goodness I didn't get into theoretical physics, because then no one would ever want to talk to me about my research. But when you study lakes, everyone has a story about a lake. Everyone's got pictures of algal blooms that they want to show you, and they want to talk to you about how they've changed. Everyone has a story about a beaver redirecting a river, you know, and flooding out a beach or something. So I love that part.
Yeah, and I'm jealous of field work. I mean, I unfortunately my profession doesn't have such a thing.
It's how we get students, for sure. It's what I always tell the students.
Yeah, right. And didn't you, like, carve out a niche for yourself because you were, you know, willing to do field work in the winter and no one else was
Studying
that time of year?
Yeah, so most of what we know about rivers and lakes comes from the summer, and that it's kind of for two reasons. Number one, it's a lot easier and more pleasant to do field work in the summer. When it's nice out and there's no ice and the roads are clear, so you can drive to your sites or whatever. And then the other thing is just like the academic calendar makes it easier to do research projects in the summer, because in the winter is typically when the classes are on. So when I was doing my PhD, my supervisor and I realized that there was this this really big gap in our knowledge about how winter processes worked in kind of central Ontario for us. And so I did four just awesome years of winter field work there. It was a real struggle to get people to come out in the field with me because it was always minus 20 and I had to like dig down into the frozen soil to pull probes out or whatever, or smash through the ice to get the on the river to get the instruments out. But it's a lot of fun and there's just so many nice things about being out in the forest in the winter. It's so still and you can see things in such a different way.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder how much of our science is biased based simply on the fact that most people who study the natural world like want to be out in the summer and teaching in the winter.
It's a huge, yeah, and it's not just like my field is about water, but it's the same, like we know a lot more about what animals do during the summer than we do about the winter. We know a lot more about plants during the summer than we do in the winter. It's just like kind of a quirk of the way the academic schedule works.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's kind of neat, though. Good for you for braving minus 20.
Yeah.
Nora, I think, I could chat, all evening, but I think we'll leave it there. Unless you want to get anything to add. I mean, how can, if people want to know more, is there any kind of resources they can go to? Or does your lab, like, have a newsletter or anything?
Yeah, well, we have a website that's kind of boring unless you're into like academic papers. But the other thing I'm involved with is something called the Climate Atlas of Canada, which is a website that has these really awesome maps of climate change across Canada, and then also a lot of storytelling around climate change, including a bunch of videos from all across Canada. So if you go to climateatlas.ca, you can zoom in on wherever in Canada you're from, look at what the climate is now and what it's projected to be in the future. And then in most places, there's some videos and some interviews with folks kind of living in the area talking about climate change.
Oh, cool. That's cool. I have not heard of that, but I will check it out. And thanks again. Good luck with the semester starting, I guess, probably next week.
Yeah.
And I hope to see you in Yellowknife before too long.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for chatting.
No, thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye.